Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Bella. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And today's program is being done in collaboration or in partnership with the MDS Foundation, Inc., and Cancer Care. And we are delighted to be partnering with them on today's program. And you'll be hearing more about the MDS Inc. Foundation as we move along in the program. Today's program is called Progress in the Treatment of Myelodysplastic Syndromes, or MDS. And today's program is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have over 150 participants on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban communities. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Germany, Ireland, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Saravansa Sanacomo, and Dr. Sanacomo is Assistant Professor, Wake Forest School of Medicine, Department of Hematologic Oncology and Blood Disorders, Levine Cancer Institute, Advocate Health. And Dr. Sanacomo will be addressing discussion of myelodysplastic syndromes, diagnosis, staging, and current standard of care, the role of hematopathology examination of a sample of your bone marrow in making a definitive diagnosis of MDS, and new and emerging treatment approaches. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sanacomo.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you. Hello, all. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today regarding MDS or myelodysplastic syndrome. As the name suggests, myelodysplastic syndrome is not just one condition, but it is a group of diseases that commonly present with cytopenias or low blood counts. In our blood, we have red blood cells that transport oxygen from the lungs to other organs, and white blood cells that attack germs and fight infections, and platelets that help with the blood clotting and stop bleeding. So when people are affected with MDS, the bone marrow, where all these blood cells are made, MDS stops the bone marrow from making normal, healthy blood cells, and that can result in like low blood counts. And that is how most of the times MDS is presented, with low blood levels of one of these blood cell types, red blood cells, causing anemia, white blood cells causing low white cell count, causing increased risk of infection, and low platelets can cause increased bleeding and bruising. So this is how most of the times MDS is presented, and MDS is more common in men older than average age, is like close to 65 to 70 years, and most of the times, cause of the etiology of cause of the MDS is not known. However, there are some factors that can increase the risk of MDS, like exposure to chemicals like benzene or other organic solvents, smoking, and exposure to chemotherapy or radiation for another condition, and also having a bone marrow failure condition like aplastic anemia. Very rarely, MDS can be familial, passed down through the genes, but most of the MDS is acquired. The second thing I wanted to talk about is the symptoms of MDS is most of the times is based on what cell lines that are affected. As we, as I said earlier, if it is low red blood cells, that can cause anemia and results in symptoms like feeling tired or having shortness of breath or chest pain on exertion, headache, or trouble like breathing, and then sometimes rapid heartbeat with exertion. And if it is a low white cells, the white blood cells affected, causing mouth sores, repeated infections in the sinus or throat, other lung infections like pneumonia or UTIs. If the platelets are low because of MDS, it can cause increased bleeding while brushing the teeth or flossing or any increased bleeding after the surgical procedures. So this is how, and sometimes nosebleeds. And if the platelet count is really low, it can cause bleeding under the skin, causing tiny flat spots called petechiae, most often seen in the lower legs. The diagnosis of MDS is made based on the low blood counts in the blood, and then the diagnosis is confirmed based on the bone marrow biopsy. Bone marrow biopsy is very critical for making the diagnosis of MDS because, as name suggests, pathology will be able to identify the dysplasia or abnormal size and shape of the bone blood forming cells in the bone marrow. So it is one of the requirements for making the diagnosis, and also what type of cells are affected and what are the different chromosomal abnormalities in these blood-forming cells in the bone marrow, and also what type of mutations that are commonly associated with MDS are identified. Because in order to make the treatment plans for MDS, we need to accurately stage the MDS. MDS being a blood disorder, the staging system is different from staging system for other solid tumors like breast cancer or lung cancer. The staging system in MDS is based on the blood counts in the peripheral blood, and also the percentage of blasts or immature cells that are found in the bone marrow, and the different chromosomal abnormalities in these bone marrow cells, and also like the type of mutations that are identified in these cells in the bone marrow. So, having a bone marrow biopsy and also having all these tests done is very critical in making appropriate staging for the MDS and ultimately the treatment decisions. There are several treatment the risk scoring systems. The one evolved over a period of time. The first one is called IPSS, or International Prognostic Scoring System, that was developed in early 2000s. It is based on the blasts or immature cells in the bone marrow and chromosomal abnormalities and blood counts. Then we have IPSSR, or Revised International Prognostic Scoring System, that was developed in 2012, which also included the not only the cytogenetics but also the it was refined compared to the initial scoring system. And recently, in the last couple of years, we have another scoring system called IPSSM, or Molecular International Prognostic Scoring System, that not only incorporates the chromosomal abnormalities and blood counts, but also the mutations that are commonly associated with the MDS, with more refined scoring system in order to make the treatment decisions. So having a bone marrow biopsy being reviewed by a well-experienced histopathologist, and getting all these tests done is very crucial in making the treatment decisions for MDS. In terms of treatments are mostly based on the scoring system, like as we discussed. Is it broadly speaking, we can categorize into low risk or high risk MDS. In low risk MDS, there may be very low blasts or immature cells in the bone marrow. There are not many chromosomal abnormalities, and also the cytopenias or blood counts are not critically low, and the mutations are not high risk, and the chance of progression to acute leukemia is lower. So usually in low-risk MDS, the main goal of the treatment is to increase the blood cells in the blood counts in the peripheral blood, so that we can improve the symptoms associated with low blood counts. Sometimes if the blood counts are not too low, we may just do what we call active surveillance, or also known as watch and wait, in this very early stage or lower risk MDS with minimal symptoms and usually without any need for blood transfusions because of the hemoglobin. So if there are symptoms or like related to the anemia, we may give transfusions in low risk MDS for red blood cells. And sometimes if the platelets are really low and causing bleeding or bruising, or particularly platelet count is less than 10,000 per microliter of blood, may need platelet transfusions. And antibiotics if the white cell count is really low to prevent any infections from happening. Sometimes we may give prophylactic antibiotics or antiviral medications. Because of the repeated transfusions that can lead to iron overload over a period of time with all these transfusions, and then we may end up using medications to decrease that iron from the body called iron chelation therapy, and there are oral or by-mouth medications available. And sometimes we give what we call growth factors for red blood cells. They are called erythropoiesis stimulating agent that can be given as a shot under the skin to improve the hemoglobin and decrease the transfusion requirements. And for low-risk MDS with anemia, there is a medication called luspatercept that is approved in patients who are transfusion dependent. It is a erythroid maturation agent that improves the anemia. And there is another medication called imetelstat. It is also approved in lower risk MDS in patients with anemia requiring transfusions. Both these medications, in addition to erythropoiesis stimulating agent, will improve the anemia and symptoms related to it, and also decrease the transfusion requirements. There is a special condition in low risk MDS called 5q deletion. It is associated with a deletion of long of chromosome 5 in these bone marrow cells that result in anemia. Particular for this condition, medication called lenalidomide. It is an immunomodulating it is a type of immunotherapy that increases the hemoglobin and improves the hemoglobin and decreases the transfusion requirements. So in this condition with the deletion 5q MDS, particularly in the low risk, lenalidomide is a pill that is taken by mouth, but it is a very good option for that particular subset. For higher risk MDS, based on the IPSSR or IPSSM score we discussed earlier, in higher risk MDS, mainstay of treatment is by type of treatment called hypomethylating agents. There are one of them is azacitidine. It is given as either under the skin subcutaneous or as an intravenous treatment, and it improves the blood counts and also decreases the transfusion requirements and improve the quality of life. And another medicine called desitabine or dacogen is another hypomethylating agent that is also given under the skin or as an IV treatment. It is usually given 5 days for every 4 week cycles. And both these medicines are used in high-risk MDS. In addition to oral or bimouth desitabine and cidazuridine, it's called Incovi. It is another oral or bimouth combination that is approved to treat in high-risk MDS. The main other treatment for higher-risk MDS is hematopoietic or bone marrow stem cell transplantation, and that has also been shown to be effective in controlling the disease and keeping the disease from coming back for a long time with increased survival. So definitely patients with higher-risk MDS need to be seen at a facility where they can evaluate for bone marrow or stem cell transplantation. Not only these treatments, there are several ongoing studies, and there are several newer treatments that are going to be available in the near future, particularly with the success of treatments in AML or acute myeloid leukemia. There are some targeted treatments that are also becoming available based on the mutations, like IDH1 or IDH2 mutations. If they're found in MDS cells, there are specific medications for those patients with the mutations. So I will stop there. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Dr. Sanakamo, that was just a superb presentation, stellar in every way, and since you are the first speaker, you've really set the tone for today's program, giving people lots of information, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. However, this has been really just a wonderful presentation, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Nilay Shah, and Dr. Shah is Assistant Professor, Cancer Medicine, Charlotte, Wake Forest University School of Medicine, Associate Fellowship Program Director, Medical Director of Education, Hematology Oncology, Atrium Health, Wake Forest Baptist Advocate Health. And Dr. Shah will be addressing the role of clinical trials, how research increases your treatment options, tips to manage symptoms, treatment side effects, discomfort, pain, and quality of life concerns. Guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, key list of questions to ask your healthcare team, and discussion of open notes, and next steps after treatment, including follow-up care in collaboration with your primary care doctor and team. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Shah.
Thanks, Dr. Venter. Dr. Sanakoma, I thought did a great job giving a good overview of a pretty tough topic in just 10 minutes. But I'm going to piggyback off a little of what he said, is that it's not one disorder. It's a series of different types of diseases that all get clumped in. And as you went through it, there's this big spectrum of different types of MDS, but unfortunately there are minimal treatment options related to either transfusions, growth factors, or one of essentially three or four FDA approved options, which are generally designed just to palliate the symptoms related to the MDS, whether that's the clinical symptoms or the blood count. But outside of allogeneic transplant, we don't have any curative options. And so I think that's where my topic comes in here, is that what are the roles and benefits of clinical trials? I think if you're not in this business, you think of a clinical trial as, hey, I'm a guinea pig, and let's see if somebody can use my body to try to advance science. And I don't think that's exactly what it is. And even in our own clinics, we struggle to try to properly explain exactly what a clinical trial is, and more importantly, not only what the benefit to the medical world is, but more importantly, what's the benefit to the patient themselves. Clinical trials are really any research study that involves human participants, in which the goal is to test new medical approaches. Often it's drugs, often it's devices, it's procedures, it's behavioral interventions, it's quality of life studies. It's trying to test anything possible that may provide benefit to the individual who's undergoing the treatment or the trial, and then more importantly, to the medical population as a whole. I think before we start, it's important to understand that there are different types of clinical trials. There are obviously interventional studies in which we're assessing a new treatment option. There's observational studies in which people are doing whatever the standard of care is or whatever they and their physician have discussed, and we're just observing them and evaluating the outcomes, right? We may already be on the right track, but it's important to kind of reiterate that and prove that with a clinical study as opposed to just saying, this is what I think. But in terms of interventional studies, when we talk about clinical trials, they're generally broken down into four phases. A phase one trial is what most people think when they hear about clinical trials. It's a small group of people. These tend to be first in human tests. And really what we're looking for is with these drugs, we're evaluating safety and dosages of a brand new drug. Oftentimes, I think, you know, in my particular practice, phase one studies tend to be limited to patients who have exhausted most options. But every now and then there are phase one drugs that you think are going to be phenomenal options based on the mechanism of action. And sometimes you introduce them earlier in your sequence of events. But for the most part, these tend to be smaller studies at one or two institutions, and you're just trying to prove that a drug is safe to use and what the right dose is. If everything qualifies and passes, then you move on to a phase two study in which the study has more participants, and now you're taking that same drug and you're actually looking to see how effective it is in a larger population, and then what are the actual side effects that we need to account for. If you feel like the drug is adequately effective and the side effects are, I guess the right word is tolerable or manageable, then you can move on to a phase three study. And a phase three study is really where all your money's at. A phase three study takes the new drug or the new intervention, and it compares to what is already on the market or the standard of care, or sometimes placebo. And here's where you're actually looking at confirming the efficacy and really taking a detailed look at what the adverse reactions or side effects are. And most FDA approvals are based on success of phase three studies. There are rare occasions where a phase two study just blows things out of the water and it's a need of treatment in that particular area and the FDA will approve it. But for the most part, you want a phase three study that says not only is the drug safe and effective, but it's better than what is currently on the market, or at least adds on to what is on the market so that you know there is a role for this drug in a patient population. And then a phase four study says the drug has already been approved. Now we want to check out what is the long-term effectiveness and safety of this drug. And then from a company standpoint, what is the optimal use of it? Where does it sequence in? Where does it fit in? How do we appropriately market it? How do we get the physicians and the providers to appropriately discuss this? So a phase four is more so an observational phase of clinical trials after the drug has already been approved and in use for some time. So why do clinical trials matter? Why do we as providers, especially providers in an academic environment, generally believe in the efficacy and need for clinical trials? Well, I think the most obvious thing is it's the creation of new treatments, right? Without clinical trials, we wouldn't know whether a new drug is actually effective in humans. Trials provide the evidence needed to bring kind of innovations from what we call bench work or lab work to the bedside or patient care. Many cancer therapies, I guess, recently approved. I think if you're thinking about immunotherapies or novel targeted agents are all available on the market because of successful clinical trials. These drugs aren't just developed in a lab and brought to the patients. They go through a series. We talked about phase ones, phase twos, phase threes, and they're studied over and over again. And these clinical trials take years from development to actual approval. And so they're important because this is how you bring new and innovative treatments that are hopefully more effective and less toxic to the patient population. Two is clinical trials they don't just bring brand new drugs to the market, but they improve on existing therapies. A clinical trial doesn't always have to be about a brand new drug in isolation. It can be about using pre-existing drugs in different combinations with different regimens, with different dosing, or adding a new drug to a pre-existing regimen. And so you can improve on what's existing without having to just simply compare one thing versus the other. Three is safety monitoring, right? Clinical trials allow us to determine not only if the drug is effective, but if the drugs, either the new drug or currently existing drugs, what are the real-world side effects? What are the actual risks? How does the body tolerate the treatment? Oftentimes, our patients are not only on one drug, but on a number of different drugs to manage either their disease or complications related to some of the other medications they're on, side effects, prophylaxis. And so you have to know in real world, how do these drugs all kind of mesh in the human body? It's hard to determine that in the lab. We think we know, but you don't want to guess on these things. So safety monitoring through clinical trials allows us to evaluate that, right? Aside from drugs, lots of clinical trials, particularly ones that we participate here at our institution, involve quality of life improvements. You are on a particular regimen that is pre-existing, but hey, how does this actually affect you? How does it affect your family? How does it affect your symptoms? How does it affect your pocket? What are the financial burdens related to the treatments? And unless we study these things, we don't know how to improve on them. Clinical trials don't just contribute to trying to improve the quantity of life, but they often help improve the quality of life. The clinical trials often bring access to cutting-edge therapies, right? There are drugs or molecules in a lab that just seem like these are going to be hits. They're not available through the FDA yet, but a patient who has a certain need and may qualify for a very specific medication may be able to access it through a clinical trial, whether it's at the institution they're at or a surrounding institution. Most of our institutions are connected via networks, whether it's groups of oncology, whether it's through transplant groups, whether it's through MDS groups, et cetera. There are ways to access medications at other centers or other companies through clinical trials that otherwise wouldn't be appropriate. So in certain scenarios, from a patient standpoint, you get access to a novel treatment before it becomes available to everybody else. All right. And then I think the last and kind of important point I'll bring out is that I think clinical trials allow us to help diversify and personalize care. Each person is different. Each person's genetic background is different. Dr. Sonnicomo just mentioned that we don't stage MDS. We base it on kind of maybe the causes, the genetic mutations that are driving it, the molecular mutations that are driving it. And each person's MDS is going to be different. And it's important for us to try to tailor and target our therapies for each individual. I've been doing this, I think, 14 years. And in those 14 years, it's remarkable how different treatments have become from one person to another in a variety of cancers and MDS in particular. And a lot of that is based on the mutations that we're developing. By using clinical trials, you can start figuring out what is the right patient, what is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time, as opposed to trying to lump everyone into a textbook and saying all MDS are the same. And so I think clinical trials help in a very good sense diversify and personalize individual care. There are challenges. There are things to consider. I hope that all these things are thought about before a clinical trial comes to a person, but you always want to make sure there are ethical considerations such as safety and informed consent. I don't think anyone should ever feel like they were kind of strong-armed into a clinical trial. They should be offered a clinical trial, the pros, the cons, what we know, what we don't know, what we're trying to achieve for the patient and for the medical community as a whole. And then the patient should have the right to decide if that trial is what they're interested in or not. Recruitment is tough. I talk about trying to diversify and personalize care based on clinical trials, but oftentimes, you know, it's what's available to you or what patient population is eligible for the trial or able to make the visits back and forth. And so there are inherent biases when you look at clinical trials. And so it's important for the company to think about that. It's also important for us as the provider when we analyze the results of the trial to see what kind of variety was actually involved, what kind of patient population was actually studied. Cost, I think for companies, for institutions, clinical trials can be expensive and time-consuming. For a patient, however, this should not add on. It shouldn't add on any financial burden. In any scenario, you hope that a clinical trial actually decreases the burden to the patient. But those are things that we all should consider. And then it's always important to remember that a clinical trial, the reason we're running the trial is because we don't know the answer yet. And so an important part of our conversation with you, the patient, or the family is that I'm not sure this is going to succeed. I don't know that this new treatment may work. I'm not sure exactly what the side effects are, particularly in the early phase trials. I believe there is a chance of benefit, which is why we're offering it to you, which is why we carry it, which is why we're participating in the trial. But if I already knew the answer to that, then the FDA would have already approved it or denied it. And so there's always a risk with a clinical trial is that there is an unknown factor about good or bad. But I think by and large, most institutions do their homework. They analyze the clinical trial that is being brought to them. Is it best for their institution? Is it best for their patient population? Are the providers comfortable offering this clinical trial? Is it a phase one? Is it a phase two? If you're comparing the trial, are you comparing to a proper regimen? If you're comparing to placebo, is it okay to say that a drug is just better than placebo? So I hope that all these questions are generally answered before it gets brought to a patient, but it's just not something that I could answer at that point. I think those are things that you have to discuss with your patients. But I think by and large, clinical trials provide us a pathway to move forward in medicine, particularly in diseases like MDS, in which treatment options are still limited to just trying to improve on symptoms.
Thank you so much, Dr. Shah. That was just a superb presentation, stellar in every way. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. She's an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian in nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in your tolerance to treatment, but also in providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Some patients experience side effects, and some don't. It's really such an individual journey. Being in communication with your healthcare team is essential, and a dietitian is part of your healthcare team. The role of the dietitian is to help support you in helping you meet your nutrition goals, whether that means making diet modifications or, bringing in suggestions to give you some more diversity in your meal plan. But in general, a whole food plant-based diet is what's recommended through all stages. And a whole foods diet is pretty much what it sounds like. It's whole foods, as close to harvest as possible. What we want to look at is we're looking at the plate is about two-thirds of the plate coming from a plant-based food, something that is close to harvest as possible. And a plant-based food is something like fruits, vegetables, grains, nuts, those sorts of things. And just to kind of put another example on it, if you want to eat something that's from an apple, just eat the apple. That's where coming as close to harvest as possible is a good example. Now, frozen and fresh are going to be superior to the canned options for our plant-based foods, so just keep that in mind. Now, the other third of the plate should come from a lean protein source, and a lean protein such as a white fowl meat, a cold water fish, a lean red meat, or you can even use your beans, peas, or lentils, or eggs and dairy as the protein source. So just knowing there's a lot of options there. Now, the sooner that you connect with your healthcare team, the sooner they can help. And so knowing how to reach them is very important. Now, some patients do have side effects, and there are medications provided. Please be sure you know how to take those medications if something comes up. If you are experiencing some specific side effects related to food, keep a record so your dietitian can help you better. Hydration is also so important, and an average kind of intake for most folks that's required is about 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, such as water, juice, milk, those sorts of things to keep you nice and hydrated. If you're going through any specialized treatment, sometimes additional fluid is required, and sometimes there's a need for a fluid restriction, so talking with your team about your unique needs is so important. So in closing, there are several members of the team dedicated just to helping you during this journey. Please know how to reach out to us, and with that, I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Pearden. That was just an excellent presentation. I'm a stellar in every way and lots of information for our participants, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ashley Moncrief. And Ms. Moncrief is Director of Patient Care at MDS Foundation, Inc. And she'll be addressing MDS Foundation's free national programs and services, and will also be giving you information about their website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague and partner on today's program, Ms. Moncrief.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here, and thank you to all for joining us today. So a little bit about the MDS Foundation. We are a global nonprofit organization that for more than 30 years has dedicated itself to supporting patients, caregivers, healthcare professionals affected by myelodysplastic syndrome. So I'm going to go over just a few of the free resources. These are global in reach for the most part. So the first is in-person education programs. We hold 6 programs in the United States and usually one outside of the U.S. per year. The full schedule for the live events will be available soon on our website for 2026. We hold 4 virtual webinars each year on a variety of topics, so if you're unable to travel, that's a good option. Other educational resources that we have, we offer 18 different educational resources in 14 languages. We also have digital programming such as Journey of Empowerment, animated patient videos, and a patient podcast series. And clinical trial awareness, as we've talked so much about today, we do have a clinical trial matching platform dedicated to MDS and related diseases through a partnership with Spark Yours. We have a support line that provides trusted information, guidance, and support for our patients and caregivers. And the foundation has been instrumental in the creation and growth of in-person and virtual support groups. We also have an MDS Exchange, which is a dedicated online community where patients and caregivers can connect, share experiences, and share your story. And finally, we host 4 Move for MDS walks around the country for awareness. Our virtual one is ongoing until the end of December if you would like to join. For more information and to access these resources, please visit the MDS Foundation website at www.mds-foundation.org or follow us on social media. We are here for you in whatever way that we can be to support. You can also reach out to us via phone at 1-800-637-0839 or email us directly at support@mds-foundation.org. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Moncrief. It's a pleasure to be partnering with you on today's program, and we look forward to future partnerships as well. This is definitely a go-to organization for everyone on the call today, so please do access resources. Please do access resources from the MDS Foundation. And I'm Carolyn Messner. I'm Senior Director of Education and Training with Cancer Care, and I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care's free national programs and services. So what are those national programs and services? So we do offer both financial and co-payment assistance. We also provide online support groups. And we also offer these workshops, of course, about 60 or 70 a year. And we have many other resources. And you can contact our HOPE line at 800-813-4673. To speak with one of our oncology social workers, or you may also visit our website at www.cancercare.org that has a much more robust listing of all the services that we offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to post online questions. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this time we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And so this is a question from one of our participants. And this will be for Dr. Senacomo. Are there any mutations that do not respond to chemotherapy?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, the mutations are important in making the staging, proper staging, and there are some mutations particularly not very good in terms of the prognosis. One of them is called TP53 mutation, especially if there are two TP53 mutations associated with the MDS, that is one of the high-risk MDS, and most of the times they don't respond very well to the treatments, and even after transplant, there is a risk of relapse after transplant. So while there are other mutations that may be also considered as higher risk, for example, ASXL1 and others, TP53 is one of the mutations that are associated with not a good response to the chemotherapy or other like treatments like hypomethylating agents, and tend to relapse even after transplant, especially if there are two TP53 mutations in two different chromosomes. And not only the mutations, but also the chromosomal abnormalities we discussed, particularly if there are multiple chromosomal abnormalities. Most of the times, it is called complex cytogenetics. And these multiple chromosomal abnormalities and TP53 often associated with what we call therapy-related MDS usually happens after chemotherapy or radiation treatment for a different cancer in the past. So those are the MDS, unfortunately, higher risk that can be resistant to the treatment.
Excellent. And for Dr. Shah, should I eliminate all sugars from my diet?
I think if we're asking about the question related to sugar and cancers developing, growing, treatment, I don't think that's a reasonable approach. I think eliminating sugars is good for your health in a variety of different reasons. But I think simply thinking that eliminating sugars will help directly treat your cancer, I'm not sure that that's appropriate or necessary. I think a balanced diet is the right way to go. And there are good sugars, there are bad sugars, and trying to find your way through that is challenging, but there's good support out there. Obviously the internet is a great access but dietitians, nutritionists at most cancer centers staff are great for trying to provide proper education regarding what maybe we should eliminate, what we should keep, what's the right way to move forward with diet and nutrition, as opposed to just blindly saying, I'm going to stop all of this or start all of this.
Excellent. Thank you. And for Dr. Senacomo, why are patients told to wait before receiving treatment? Are there any preventative steps that can be taken before things progress?
Yeah, that is an excellent question that we are trying to answer with more observation and also hopefully in the future we will have some answers. But right now, as we discussed earlier, if somebody has low risk or very low risk MDS without any transfusions, most of the times we tend to wait, watch and wait, or active surveillance we call it, instead of treating, because some of these treatments are associated with side effects. However, we are looking into trying to address some of the mutations that we can target, for example, the IDH1, IDH2 mutations, and there are currently clinical trials ongoing to see if we can eliminate these mutations sooner, and if it makes any difference in terms of overall survival, and also decrease the chance of progression to higher risk MDS or acute leukemia. So the clinical trials are ongoing, but most of the times if the cytopenias are mild and if it is a low risk or very low risk MDS, we tend to watch and wait.
Awesome, thank you. And for Dr. Shah, what is the difference between, you know, are there clinical trials for MDS patients? What can I find, where can I find more information?
Sure. There's a website called clinicaltrials.gov. And on that, you can essentially find every clinical trial that is established at the institutions at which they're being run, the phases in which they're being run, and oftentimes how far along they are in their accruals and how much eligibility is left. I think one of the challenging things is clinical trials are often geographically based. And so if you are, it's hard to be treated by a clinical trial if it's not at your institution because of the frequency at which things are evaluated, whether that's blood work or just a clinical evaluation. And so I think you can do some research yourself by going to clinicaltrials.gov and just evaluating what's out there. I think the best approach and what we tell most of our patients is find the closest academic institution to you. Find a dedicated MDS provider. General oncologists are great in the community, and most of the time they can appropriately treat you with the drugs at hand. However, when it comes to clinical trials, more often than not, you're better served at an academic institution. And so find the closest one to you, find a dedicated MDS provider, and have these conversations in real time. I think not only will you find trials that may or may not be eligible for you, but you may save yourself some time and some hassle of traveling to a place to seek a clinical trial that actually doesn't have an option for you. Clinical trials are very specifically based for individuals, right? Like we talked about earlier, we're trying to tailor and target therapies. And so just because you have MDS, if you don't have this mutation or that mutation or this genetic analysis, or you're not of this age or that age, you may or may not be eligible for different trials. And so you want to get all that information out of the way before you take the time to go seek a clinical trial. But I think the right thing to do is find the closest academic MDS provider to you at whatever institution is near you and ask these questions in person. And more often than not, there are trials available for you.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Senacomo, are MPNs and MDS related at all?
So MPNs are myeloproliferative neoplasms, or a group of conditions where there is an excess production of the blood cells, like platelets or hemoglobin, for example. MDS, on the other hand, is where the blood cell production is ineffective, meaning like the bone marrow is not able to produce the cells in an appropriate fashion because of the underlying bone marrow dysfunction. So there are two, they both are a different group of diseases. However, sometimes there is an overlap called MDS-MPN overlap conditions, where there is a decrease in some blood counts with some dysplasia or abnormalities in the bone marrow, but also the features of MPN, where there is an excess production of platelets or as such. So MPNs are distinct from MDS, but there are sometimes overlap conditions.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I'm going to ask our speakers now to provide a takeaway for today's program. So I'm going to start with Dr. Senacomo. If you would like to provide just a takeaway, a minute or so takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Yeah. Thank you so much for all of you to attend this and the organizers for organizing this meeting. The fact that you are here shows that you are interested in learning more about MDS and visiting a trusted source like MDS Foundation to learn more about the condition. And most importantly, as Dr. Shah suggested, to seek a second opinion, if at all possible, to make sure not only that the diagnosis is accurate and also you know, you are appropriately staged, you know, either low risk or high risk, as we discussed, and also to have an opportunity to discuss about the stem cell transplant when appropriate, because that is a potential, that can offer a potential cure for these conditions. So it is very important to not only work with your local hematologist, but also to seek an expert in MDS to make sure you get the appropriate treatment. Thank you.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Senekomo. And Dr. Shah, your takeaway?
Yeah, I think my takeaway is that I think treating any cancer, but I think treating these blood cancers and MDS in particular takes a team. You know, Dr. Senekomo just, I think in his brief introduction, mentioned all the different parts that go into just getting to the diagnosis, from a provider recognizing it to a pathologist looking at a bone marrow and appropriately calling something dysplastic or not, or the level of dysplasia, or the level of the leukemia cells, to the geneticist able to appropriately read the molecular mutations or the cytogenetic abnormalities, to an MDS provider offering different treatment options, to a transplant physician maybe or maybe not offering treatment, to a clinical trials team, the dietitian, the nutritionist, supportive care measures such as pain control or symptom control. And so I think the big takeaway here is for every patient, there are numerous means of support through the MDS Foundation, through your local cancer center, through your local institution, and take advantage of what's available to you instead of trying to do this all on your own. I think there is more support than patients realize. And while it's our job to try to make patients aware, it's also your own benefit to advocate for yourself and try to seek as much assistance as you can where you can.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Nishman Kreef?
Yeah. Well, thanks for being here. And I guess my takeaway would be that, you know, we envision a world where, yes, you may have MDS, but it doesn't have to have you per se. And, you know, knowledge is power. So being here today is the first step into making that a reality. And just know that you're not alone. So if there's something we can do, myself, the MDS Foundation, and everyone else on this call would love to help. So just feel free to reach out.
And definitely MDS Foundation is a go-to organization for everyone on the call today. We will be providing all of you with the websites, with the telephone numbers, with all the information that we can provide you. You will be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation within about 10 days after the program. And in that evaluation, there'll be an evaluation of the program, but we'll also be sending you all the information that we provided in terms of websites, telephone numbers, hope lines, all that stuff will be sent to you. So you'll be having all that information at your fingertips as well. And I really just want to thank everyone for participating today. I have to say that our speakers have been phenomenal and our participants have been really great and phenomenal as well. And although we've done this program before, I have to say that the questions have been really superior and our speakers have been superior. So this is probably the best program we've ever done so far. And I just want to thank you so much for participating. Please be aware that Cancer Care offers a host of services, so you'll be able to access that information as well. And again, I want to wish you all a very fine day and thank you all for your participation. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.